This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Imagine being tripped over and over again, knowing that it would keep happening, but never knowing when. Sounds like a nightmare, right? Well, it's exactly what some people have volunteered to do in order to help make prosthetic legs better. Shane King is a graduate student at Vanderbilt University. He designed the system that did the tripping, and he's lead author of a new paper documenting the results of the experiment. Shane, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Let's just make sure we're on the same page to begin with. I mean, prosthetic legs have developed amazingly in recent years. Where are we on the scale between like peg leg and thought controlled? Presumably somewhere in the middle there.
Yeah, I'd say at this point we're definitely not at thought controlled by any means, but we're at a very good point compared to peg leg. So at this point, if someone's wearing pants that covers their leg, a lot of times people won't even notice that someone's using a prosthesis if it's well-tuned and well-fitted to their height. It looks like normal motion as long as it's not anything too arduous. So if you're just walking over level ground in the office or on a sidewalk, it's hard to even say that you could recognize it if you can't actually see the device itself.
And is that the result entirely of mechanical refinements, or is there software involved in that?
So it's a bit of both. There are plenty of legs out there right now, prosthetic devices, that are purely mechanical, and they work very well. They're not as robust in safety to a point, and then also that sort of looking like a normal human gait, able-bodied gait. Those are typically the microcontroller prostheses. So those do use software so they can change the damping. So there's like a viscous fluid in there that they use that they can make more or less viscous. So it can change the rate of swing of the leg, so it can you can walk with different cadence, and you can really fine-tune the motion of the leg that way.
And yet handling the possibility of being tripped, handling obstacles that might stumble someone is still a challenge for these legs, right?
Definitely, definitely. So the obvious one that affects all legs, no matter what, is that people who use these devices don't get that same feeling that someone who has both legs gets when they hit an obstacle. You feel it right away. You get this reflexive response. At best, with a prosthesis, you feel the vibrations up through your residual limb. So it's a slow response if you even notice at all. What ends up happening a lot of times is people start to hop on their unaffected leg until they can get back into their rhythm and bring their prosthesis back out in front of them again, and they can start to land on it. And even then, once you start to land on it, it's a slow transition back to walking. A lot of times they have to stop and recover and readjust.
Well, Shane King, I wonder, in deciding to try to work on this challenge of making prosthetic legs that would better be able to handle the challenges of encountering an obstacle and not tripping, ideally, not falling, at what point did you realize that in order to do this, we're going to have to actually trip people over and over and over to understand the problem?
So we knew that pretty much right from the get-go. We didn't know exactly how we were going to do it, and that was sort of what the first year or so of my graduate school and my co-contributor Mara Eveld's graduate school program was just developing this device so that we could actually have a test bed for what we were hoping to design with the actual robotic leg itself.
So describe this system, because it's not by any means simple. You've got so many different things wrapped into this complete system in order to be able to have volunteers who have to be repeatedly tripped without knowing that it's coming, and yet kept safe enough that they don't actually fall and hurt themselves.
Right. So there's like the physical apparatus that we created, which is essentially a ramp with a big steel block on it. So it's just like a sort of, we call it a roller coaster, because it's these two acrylic tracks, and this 35-pound solid steel block has four bearings that kind of look like, or four sets of bearings. It's like a stack, but they kind of look like roller coaster wheels that lock into this channel. And we have an electromagnet, and when we release that electromagnet, this block slides down the ramp so smoothly that you can't even feel the vibrations, because that was a major issue in previous studies as well as in our initial like pilot designing.
Because the person would then know it was coming.
Exactly. So if there was any vibration at all, people would at the very least kind of get this like, is that? And then they would like stiffen up. Or if it was enough, we had some early testing where people would just step right over it. As soon as they felt it, they would step right over it. And so
it's amazing that we respond that intuitively and that quickly to right. any possible idea that there might be an obstacle in our way.
Right. And it doesn't hurt that people were, especially initially before we figured out how to keep people's minds off the task, people were a little stressed. Certain subjects, at least, were a little stressed and high anxiety about it.
That
walking
sounds
a little.
Like an understatement to me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There was definitely some that didn't have a lot of fun doing it. A lot of high knees walking and like really lifting your toes up a lot as you walked. And so we had to come up with some pretty fun ways to get people to sort of calm down and not think about it.
So how did you do that?
So obviously couldn't have you, the subjects, looking at the block. So for that, we used dribble goggles. So like what they train children to dribble basketballs with, where they just block your lower field of view. The final sort of piece that we have there is we make the subjects do serial sevens, which is essentially just we give them a random large number and they count backwards by sevens. So super grueling. It's always everyone's least favorite part. And it keeps them really preoccupied, though.
Yeah. I'm not sure I could count backward by sevens and walk at the same time. It's definitely harder than walking and chewing gum.
Oh, yeah. It's tough. People are always really self-conscious, and they're like, oh, you're not gonna make sure I'm correct, are you? And I'm like, oh, no, don't worry. We're just going to make sure you're not counting by like ones or twos.
Well, and then the final piece in this is that everybody who's doing this is actually wearing a safety harness, but it's mm-hmm. a dual purpose. It's a safety harness, but it's also how you measure whether or not the person would have fallen, right?
Right. So there's that component. Then additionally, even before the harness is needed, there's also our sort of the computer side of the whole thing. So we've got this block and this ramp and the magnet, right? But then there's actually this whole computer algorithm that is being run in the background that figures out exactly when we need to release the giant block so that we can very specifically target percentages of your swing phase when your foot's off the ground. But yes, so from there, we do have a full body harness on them for safety because there's no handrails because we don't want them grabbing handrails because that would totally change. You don't have handrails in real life when you're walking on the sidewalk and trip on the curb. So we had to get rid of those. And from there, we still need to make sure that if they fell, they didn't actually fall and land on the treadmill and slide off the back or anything like that. So we gave them this full body harness and attached it to a load cell. And so the load cell actually measures the force that's being applied or that the rope is providing. So like the assistance, how much of their body weight is being held up through that harness. And while that wasn't really an integral part of the study for the healthy subject study that we just published on, since only one subject fell one time in that study, that's going to play a lot larger role in our future studies where we are working with our devices and with subjects with amputation.
So you managed to line up subjects to actually volunteer to be tripped over and over and over, close to 200 times, never know it was coming, being tripped at all these different points in their walking gait so that you can figure out what tripping looks like, the mechanics of it, maybe how we handle it. And I understand you actually yourself volunteered to, in the development, you had this done to yourself. And I can imagine this could go two ways. It could be incredibly stressful, bordering on traumatic, or it could be kind of hysterically funny that you're just constantly tripping.
Oh, yeah.
What was it like to actually do this?
It definitely went both ways at times. It was It was especially in the beginning, it was a little more of that traumatic nature where it was when it was the first time is always really big. So you're really worried about it. I remember I definitely put it off. I think I was the last of our three initial pilot testers to go. And for us pilot testers, it was definitely a few hundred times each. I think one of our lab mates one day, I think we stumbled him like 70 times in one day.
Oh, my goodness.
So there's definitely these large amounts of tripping and stumbling ourselves that was going on. So by the end, it became a lot more rhythmic almost. You were quite like, it wasn't that you were responding different because it's still a reflexive response, but that anxiety goes away. So you're not worried about it. You're not as stressed about it. If anything, you get a little more relaxed and a little bit more like you probably normally would be when you trip. But it definitely gets funny going back and watching the videos of ourselves doing it. And then we tried it with an adapter so that we could test it out on a prosthesis. And that was definitely a bit more traumatic. We actually put a heart rate monitor on me when we did it. And I was so nervous that the first time it happened when I fell, I think my heart rate reached like 180 beats per minute or something insane. And it felt like, in my mind, it felt like learning to fall as an adult if you never learned to fall as a kid. That is kind of what it felt like, where it was just like you knew you were going to fall, but you didn't know how to handle it. And it was definitely a little more anxiety-inducing than just regular walking with both legs and stumbling.
And potentially a really valuable insight into the experience of those who have to wear a prosthetic limb.
Definitely.
Right. You were doing it as a volunteer and it was temporary, but obviously you're doing this to help people for whom this is daily life and a daily challenge.
Exactly. And what we want to do is we want to get everything working as well as we possibly can before we start to bring participants in to actually wear our devices and to test out the system with their device, their daily use device. So we want to make sure that we're not wasting their time.
Well, so Shane King, what you're alluding to here is if you're going to carry this through to the point of designing better prosthetic limbs and testing whether those new designs actually do work and handle tripping scenarios better, eventually you're going to have to bring in individuals wearing their current prosthetics and then wearing your newly designed prosthetics and go through this same tripping process. But there's a lot to do between now and then. I mean, what have you learned from this initial study watching and measuring the trip responses of able-bodied individuals?
Yeah, so you're exactly correct. There's a good bit to go before we get to the sort of final product or the end goal. With the biomechanics, we're taking all this data and we're going through it and we're trying to figure out the why of how people respond, because there's actually a lot of different ways. And we're trying to figure out what the body uses to determine which strategy it uses to recover. Like what factors and what variables do a good job describing or classifying which strategy you're going to choose. So it might not be exactly like what the human body does, but it's these variables that we can look at and that can potentially be used in future prostheses to make the stumble recovery even better. But then on that other branch, what we're doing is we're still moving ahead with our original robotic prosthesis that Vanderbilt developed. We're going to try to find a way that we can best provide that support and structure to an individual with an amputation without making it more difficult for them. Because you could think of a situation where your leg does something, your prosthesis does something that you're not expecting that actually makes it even harder to recover and you're more likely to fall without trying to go too far overboard and make something that's either more dangerous or more problematic or something that the user doesn't trust.
Right. I mean, if the leg actually detects the obstacle before you do, because as you were saying, you can't necessarily feel it. You only get that indirect message that there's an obstacle there to respond to. Somehow, your body and your prosthesis need to respond to that in a coordinated way.
Right. Right. So that's a lot of what we're trying to work through right now is figuring out what factors and what variables we can use to sort of more simply, initially, figure out a response so that the subject, the user, isn't surprised and that it still does a better job and makes it a lot less of a risky or dangerous activity. Because right now, currently, people with transfemoral amputation are 200 times more likely to fall than their age-match healthy equivalents. So it's a lot higher risk of falling and then subsequently a lot higher risk of injuries that come out of falling. So our hope is that by meeting in the middle, we'll be able to reduce that by a significant amount.
Maybe a little bit of humor factor in tripping people over and over for research, but serious and important research. Shane King, a Vanderbilt University graduate student who has developed a system that does trip people over and over, but in order to develop better prosthetic legs. Shane, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Jupiter's Great Red Spot. It's one of the most recognizable features of any planet in our solar system, right up there with Saturn's rings. And remarkably, it's a storm, a really huge storm that's been raging for hundreds of years. But it seems to be changing. Observers say it's shrinking, and they've seen wisps peeling off in recent months. So what does that mean? Amy Simons is a senior planetary scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Can you just describe some of the changes in the red spot that have been seen in recent months?
Sure. So we've been monitoring the Great Red Spot actually for a number of years now using the Hubble Space Telescope. And one of the things we noted was, besides getting smaller, which we've observed for decades, it was actually getting much more intense in color, a very deep orange. And it turns out that at the same time it's been shrinking inward, it's actually getting taller. So it's extending higher up into the atmosphere, and we think it's being exposed to even more sunlight and ultraviolet radiation. So it's essentially getting a sunburn.
Wow. So it's actually not necessarily total volume getting smaller, but it sounds like it's kind of being squeezed, getting narrower and taller, like more of a column.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like the potter's wheel where you have your spinning clay, and if you push on it, it'll get taller. Same sort of idea.
And then some amateur astronomers have also noticed perhaps wisps, something kind of spinning off of it.
Yeah, that's a little bit confusing. And so we're looking at that now. When you're talking about this, you're talking about essentially a storm. So you're not talking about a solid object. You're talking about wind and cloud. And what we see is that the winds that go around the great red spot are kind of partially responsible for the way it spins, but they also interact with it. Clouds get pulled in and they get torn apart. Sometimes they pass along, but sometimes they make these wisps. And so the question is, when we see a new one, was it something from inside the spot itself or something from the outside that just didn't get pulled all the way in?
I mean, you say a spinning storm. Is this essentially like a hurricane? How big would this be if it were on Earth?
So it is quite a bit like a hurricane, except it's not a low-pressure storm like a hurricane. It's a high-pressure storm. So it's actually an anti-hurricane or an anti-cyclone. So that's really the only difference. It's spinning the opposite direction, and it's high pressure. And this one, it started out when we were really observing it in a lot of detail, say back when Voyager 1 or 2 flew by in the 70s. It was about three times the size of the Earth.
Wow.
And because it's been shrinking, it's now about just a little bit bigger than the Earth. But still, that concept of a storm, the size of the planet is, you know, it's mind-boggling.
A little bit mind-blowing, for sure. And it's a storm that's been going for hundreds of years, right?
Right. We've been tracking it back to see exactly when it formed, and we don't know. So we have records that go back into the 1800s, actually, and I've even used them in my research, which is a lot of fun. But it's been continuously tracked since the late 1800s. But there were reports actually in the late 1600s by Cassini and by other famous astronomers where they thought they saw a permanent spot on Jupiter.
The actual person Cassini, not the spacecraft Cassini.
Exactly, the person. very early telescopes, they were seeing what they thought was a permanent spot. But we can't prove it was the same one. It doesn't seem like it was the right size or location. It might have been a precursor. Could have been a completely different storm. We just don't know because there weren't any reports of it after the early 1700s. So there's that gap of 150 years in there. But that aside, we're still talking a storm that's lasted 150 years. And that's, you know, again, it's just crazy.
Well, Amy Simon, as a planetary scientist looking around our solar system and perhaps beyond, this idea of a storm that is larger than our planet is pretty mind-blowing. But how rare or unusual is it?
It's rare in the sense that we don't have any storms that last this long. We don't see storms like this on Saturn. We see them on Neptune. Now, the ones on Neptune can be just as big, but they don't last very long. And that's because of how the winds are set up on those planets are quite different. And so on Jupiter, the jet streams are very constant. They're always blowing the same speed in the same direction. And so they kind of confine these storms into channels, and that helps to keep them stable for so long.
And you said that you've been seeing changes in Jupiter's great red spot for a decade or more in terms of changing size, the kind of wisps of stuff that we're not sure what they are. That's a more recent thing. But how surprising are any of these changes?
In some ways, they're not that surprising. When we make computer models of a storm, it's actually very hard to get them to last very long. And what we've seen is when something kind of coalesces and forms, it tends to get smaller and smaller until it breaks apart. So from that perspective, I think it's maybe not unusual, but I grew up seeing the Voyager pictures of Jupiter, you know, and as you said, the Great Red Spot's one of the most recognizable storms in the solar system. And so the idea that we can watch it changing in our lifetime is, you know, that's pretty incredible. That's teaching us a lot about how atmospheres work.
Does that mean that you think maybe we are seeing the end of Jupiter's Great Red Spot, that we could see that within our lifetime?
It's actually quite possible. The fact that it's gotten so much smaller, it's likely to do one of two things. It'll either stabilize where it is and stop shrinking, or if it continues to grow taller because it now encounters different high-level winds up at the top, it can actually get pulled apart, which is one of the ways hurricanes get broken apart on Earth. So Yeah, it's actually quite possible we could see that sort of change in our lifetime.
And as you mentioned, for those of us who grew up seeing images of this, and that's kind of our image of Jupiter, is that side of the planet with that big red spot there. It seems kind of bizarre and maybe even sad to think about that going away. But oftentimes when you talk to the people who study these things, what seems like an unfortunate event for the rest of us is actually a really exciting learning opportunity. And you already mentioned that you're already learning more about this storm. I mean, is this kind of an exciting thing for you?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, atmospheric scientists and even oceanographers, fluid dynamicists, always like to see things change, because that's when we can actually test our models and test the equations. We know they're supposed to work, but if nothing is changing, it's hard to see that they're doing what we expect. So when you see a change like this, it kind of disturbs the whole region. It gives us a chance to really check those models out and check out those equations, make sure we understand everything that goes into them. So yeah, we're excited to watch it change.
And what do those models tell you about? Is it just about the atmosphere of Jupiter, or are there lessons that we could learn from the Great Red Spot that would teach us about hurricanes on Earth or storms elsewhere in the universe?
It's actually rather interesting if you look at the history of how we studied these things going way back before we had computers. Everything was on paper, and it was these incredibly complicated mathematical equations. And eventually we got to the point where we made computer models to try to model an atmosphere, model circulation. And the first of those, of course, was for the Earth. But again, computer power was quite limited. So certain things had to be hard-coded into the computer model just to make it run in a reasonable amount of time. And as we have more and more data, we find it gets harder and harder sometimes to predict climate and to predict circulation. And so having a case like Jupiter or any of the giant planets, they're sort of the same equations and different boundary conditions. We don't have land. We have different rotation rates. We're farther from the sun. So now we can put all those variables back in, and your physics should work the same on all the planets. So if we have our models correct on Earth, they should also work on Jupiter, on Mars, on any other planet. And so, yeah, having an event like this that, gee, if we can't get the model to match this and work, that's telling us we don't have all the details right in the model. And if we can fix those little things for Jupiter, we can also take them back the other direction, and that model should still work on Earth. So yeah, I think we can use these sorts of things and learn about all the planets at the same time.
Amy Simon is a senior planetary scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center studying Jupiter's Great Red Spot. Amy, thanks so much.
Thank you.